Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 605, interview with Dean McLeod and Peter Vogel about Port Chicago. This has been recorded on August 5th of the year 2007. And once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Peter Vogel, the author of The Last Wave of Port Chicago, Last Wave from Port Chicago, and Dean McLeod, the author of the soon-to-be-published Images of America, Port Chicago, that is going to be issued by Arcadia Press on September 15th. Gentlemen, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Yes, thanks, Dave.
Before we run down the subject material, before we get into the meat of the discussion, Dean, my understanding is that I have been mischaracterizing Port Chicago. Correct me.
Only in a linguistic kind of a way. The term Port Chicago has become conflated, confusing the town from the naval installation. And the naval installation went through numerous name changes, but for most of the time was known as the Concord Naval Weapons Station. It had the advantage of separating it from the place that it actually was, which was adjacent to the town of Port Chicago. But frequently when people think of Port Chicago, they think of the military installation, and that wasn't what it was called by the Navy.
I'll stick this in here just to update it for the listeners here, that the Department of Defense transferred, transferred the Concord Naval Weapons Station, the former Port Chicago Naval Weapons Depot, transferred the Concord facility from the Navy to the Army's Military Transportation Command. And what we once knew as Port Chicago and then knew as the Concord Naval Weapons Station is now the Army's Military Ocean Terminal, Concord.
Well, now, inside one, Dean related for us how the tiny town of Port Chicago, if I'm not mistaken, some 3,500 residents as of 1968, Dean?
I think the population had declined by then because it had been strangling economically, but at its maximum, which was in the mid-50s, it was 3,500.
Anyway, they were relocated. The eminent domain was declared, and they were basically relocated out of their homes in the city of Port Chicago, or the town of Port Chicago, which in the meantime had become a major embarkation point for nuclear weapons to be deployed in the Pacific Theater during the Cold War. Peter, let's go back to the very first, your point of embarkation, so to speak, keeping the metaphor, on this particular voyage. You were at a rummage sale in New Mexico. Tell us what you found and how some people reacted to it.
Yes, Dave. It was the Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church in Santa Fe, out on the Santa Fe Trail. It was a spring 1980 rummage sale at the church, and I was going through boxes looking for vintage photographic materials that I could use in my own darkroom to get special effects. And I found a box that did have mid-1940s photographic materials in it. At the bottom of the box was a number 10 white envelope that had a piece of paper folded up in it, and you know, it was fairly thick. I took this paper out while I was sitting on the floor there at the rummage sale and unfolded it, and the title of the document is History of 10,000-Ton Gadget. It is composed of 11 steps in the progression, which begins with detonation and ends in the bottom line with the statement, ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. Now, I was then working in the state of New Mexico. I was working with a number of physicists and mathematicians who had been at Los Alamos during World War II, and I took this document around to these people when we'd meet, and I'd say, what's the bottom line here mean? Ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. And they said, well, we never heard of it. But talk to Ed Teller, that is Dr. Edward Teller.
Father of the hydrogen bomb.
Father of the hydrogen bomb. Talk to Dr. Teller and ask him what Port Chicago was, and he will know. So I made a date to meet with Dr. Teller, with whom I'd studied physics at Berkeley in the mid-1960s, so I knew him. Set up an appointment for August 27th, 1980, and I met with him at his office at Los Alamos. And I had a Nikon motor drive camera and a big strobe and a battery pack, and had told his secretary that I'd be taking pictures of him. And I put this document, The History of 10,000-Ton Gadget, into his hands and started taking pictures. And I said, read this, well, I take your picture. And he got into it, and I said, all right, now, Ed, turn around and look right into the lens. And I positioned myself in such a way that the document that he was reading, the history of 10,000-ton gadget, is identifiable in the photograph, and recorded several images of him reading this document. And then I said, well, Ed, Dr. Teller, what is the significance of the bottom line where it says ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion? And he looked at me and he said, well, it's not Port Chicago, it's Port Arthur, Texas. And I said, no, it's not Port Arthur, it's Port Chicago. What is Port Chicago? And then he got agitated and he said, he handed the document back to me and he said, I'll deny that I've ever seen this document. I'll deny that I've ever spoken about Port Chicago with you. You probably have a classified document. You should take it to the classification office here at the lab immediately.
In other words, he went nuclear.
Yeah, so to speak. Well, so that's the way it got started. Then that was the spring. That was August of 1980, and I was scheduled then, knew I would be appointed by the governor of the state of New Mexico to work in the state's energy programs, and we were going to set up the Energy Institute for the state, and we needed a board of directors, high-powered board, and the governor and other people suggested that the director of Los Alamos at that time, Dr. Donald M. Kerr, who then used the designation Junior but no longer does, I went to Los Alamos and met with Dr. Kerr in his office to persuade him to be the cornerstone of excellence for the board of directors of the New Mexico Energy Research and Development Institute. And he basically agreed to do it. And then I took out the history of 10,000-ton gadget, put it into his hands, and I said, well, you know, you can do it, but you have to be aware of the fact that I'm going to be the secretary of the board. I am by statute and ex officio secretary of the board, and I believe Port Chicago was nuked. And here's the document. Take a look at it. And he said, well, I'll get on the phone. I'll talk to Dr. Teller, and he'll deny any sense to that notion that you have. And I said, well, don't bother. I've already talked to him, and I've photographed him reading it. And after that time, we worked 3 years together and got along quite well during that time with occasional little spats in the men's room. But we flew around the state and traveled extensively together and conducted the business of the state in energy research for 3 years. And he had told me at the time of my first meeting with him, I said, I believe I'm reasonably persuaded that Los Alamos and the Navy detonated a low-yield experimental nuclear weapon at Port Chicago on the 17th of July, 1944. And he said, you'll never be able to prove it. And I said, well, I'll do the best that I can. And that was 1980. Now, subsequently, Dr. Kerr, well, let's say 6 years ago, he was the director of the FBI laboratory division and assistant director of the FBI. And when I realized that I was going to be able to get this book finished, that it was going to be published on the web by the Contra Costa County Office of Education as I wrote it, I sent him an email. And I said, the book is coming. We should talk about it. And he then wrote me back by snail mail, you know, U.S. Postal Service, and said, what are the issues? And I said, well, from my perspective, the issues are two. In the first place, I believe that the declaration of war against the Empire of Japan that was established by the United States Congress and got us into World War II, that provided a legitimate basis for the test of this weapon at Port Chicago, because it committed the entire resources of the United States and the military, that is the Navy and the Army, to the successful completion of the war. And if you commit everything, the total resources, that means you can basically do anything that's not illegal. And I found no reason in military law that it would be illegal to detonate a weapon and proof, even though it was going to could be well anticipated to cause casualties, deaths, injuries, and destruction. The other issue I said was, I think, you know, that it can be reasonably shown that officials of the United States government, Los Alamos and the National Archives, have acted in concert to deny information that's pertinent to my research, and that's illegal. So that was it. Now, Dr. Kerr is now, and has been for about 3 years, the deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he's in charge charge. He's deputy in charge of science and technology there, although recently he's been, his name has come up as whether or not he would be nominated to run the CIA. And I think he's, my understanding is that he says, I don't want any part of that.
Peter, could I jump in? Is that the same Kerr family as Kerr-McGee Engineering, which maintains nuclear power plants, among other facilities?
It is not.
Okay.
Kerr family, that's Dean McGee of Oklahoma City, and it was Kerr McGee. Mr. McGee, though, incidentally, served on the board of directors of the New Mexico Institute.
It's just a small point in passing. Peter, in your very first article, Last Wave from Port Chicago, from the Black Scholar of 1982, spring issue, as I recall, you cited a number of pieces of physical evidence that the Port Chicago explosion has to have been a nuclear explosion and could not have been the detonation of conventional munitions on an ammunition ship, as it was officially said to be the case. If you, granted this is a subject for a broadcast in and of itself, and we've done several in the past, could you briefly encapsulate that physical evidence, the flash, the Wilson condensation cloud, the actual force of the blast, etc.? And then I'd like to get into the discussion of the memoranda that not only you unearthed, but also Mr. McLeod has come across some tremendous supplemental information, which really, I think, opens an entire new vista and deepens the work that you've done and confirms it in a very dramatic fashion. Encapsulate the physical evidence that it was a nuke for us.
Well, the first evidence, Dave, is the fireball from the explosion. And the history of 10,000-ton gadget, that document that was made at Los Alamos in winter of 44-45, says that the anticipated Trinity fireball will occur in typical Port Chicago fashion. So a nuclear weapon detonation, because of the temperature and heat are so great compared to the detonation of chemical explosives like TNT or Torpex, the difference of temperature and heat creates an entirely distinctive fireball. And that those distinctive differences have to do with the size of the fireball and particularly the rate of ascent. That is, how fast this fireball moves from the surface, how fast it moves in its rise into the sky. Because of the great heat, it moves very much more rapidly and much higher into the sky than the fireball from a TNT or Torpex explosion. So the fireball is really the definitive characteristic of the Port Chicago explosion, and Los Alamos had defined the Port Chicago explosion fireball as being typical of a nuclear explosion. So that's really now that fireball was observed by pilots of two Army Air Corps planes that were flying light of sight towards the Port Chicago, and they were, one was at 3,000 feet and the other was at 9, so they were able actually to give a very precise timing for the rate of ascent of the fireball from the moment of the explosion until it reached first 3,000 feet and then 10,000 feet, so that these two pilots were able to very accurately describe for Los Alamos and also in the Court of Inquiry proceedings, very, very accurately describe this fireball, how fast it rose and how high it went. And that's the most definitive. Now, we also have this Wilson condensation cloud. And you get the atmosphere at sea level, especially in a marine environment like that, the atmosphere is fairly well saturated with moisture. And when an explosion occurs, you have this radiating force, this pressure wave that is going out in a sphere front from the explosion. And as that passes through the atmosphere, first it compresses this wet atmosphere. And after it passes, the temperature immediately cools below the dew point, so that all of a sudden you have this big circular or hemispherical fog bank, fog cloud that lasts probably a second or two. And the pilots who were flying line of sight toward Port Chicago, one of them said, you know, there was this extraordinary donut-shaped smoke cloud that radiated out from Port Chicago to a radius of 3 miles. And it was just an enormous smoke. Now, there is some evidence that even small explosions in the circumstances of a water-laden atmosphere will create a Wilson condensation cloud. But what we had at Port Chicago was enormous. And it's my view, and in consequence of discussions that I've had with a number of physicists and mathematicians, that the dimensions of the condensation cloud, which was formed at Port Chicago, could not be achieved by the temperature and pressure wave of entirely conventional explosives, and therefore we have to look for another reason, and that would be the detonation of the Mark II weapon, as I propose it. Now, there are a number of other things. The formation of the crater was exactly consistent with the formation of the crater beneath the atomic weapons that were detonated at Bikini under very similar circumstances. Identical with the crater that was formed by the first British test in the Montebello Islands off Australia. You know, it's just exactly, it corresponds to every reported nuclear weapon test that we have access to.
Peter, let me jump in very quickly because we've got about 10 minutes left in the broadcast. You also point out in your original article, as well as in your book, the contrasts between past ammunition ship explosions and the percentage of the explosives that go off high order and what happened with Port Chicago. And you also, in your online book, have answered questions that have been brought up by critics. One, how come there aren't higher radiation levels? And you've recently developed information that, in fact, there are some areas where the radiation level is higher than would be expected from background, and also evidence that flash burns were present on some of the victims of Port Chicago. What I'd like to do, we have got, unfortunately, just a limited amount of time left. You eventually came across information, you developed an hypothesis that what actually went off at Port Chicago was something called the Mark II. If you could briefly sum up what the Mark II is, and then I'd like to bring Dean McLeod back in because he has supplemented your work on some absolutely stunning memoranda that were being circulated among people who were involved with the Manhattan Project, the development of nuclear weapons, and they were consummately involved with the investigation of Port Chicago. Tell us about the Mark II, Peter, and then for the bulk of the broadcast, I'd like Dean and Peter to show us the actual documentary timeline that, to my way of thinking, really points very conclusively to Peter's Mark II hypothesis being valid.
Good. I'm going to be real brief because I want to get to what Dean McLeod has developed here, which is very important. Radiation. I first want to call the listeners' attention to the fact that Ian Kluft, Kluft, on the web has a very extensive article called Background Radiations Near Port Chicago. And that's by Ian Kluft, and he has very thoroughly mapped anomalously high radiation levels that are downwind from Port Chicago across Suisun Bay. And it's very important to look at that, Ian Kluft, Background Radiations Near Port Chicago. Now, the Mark II, there's only one reference in the published literature to the Mark II, and it just says there that it could be used with either plutonium or uranium-235. Now, that document, the document from which that information is taken, I finally found. It's by James Conant, written by James Conant, Harvard University president, and he reports having a discussion with Oppenheimer at the University of Chicago, and he says, "You should test the Mark II, make plans as soon as possible to test the Mark II, and if it's successful, you can put it on the shelf. And people can work on the more powerful weapons with less nervousness." So the critical words there are, if it works, if the test is successful, put it on the shelf.
Very quickly, Mr. Conant and J. Robert Oppenheimer, two of the principal people involved with the Manhattan Project. Continue, Peter.
Yes, all right. So put it on the shelf. Test it. If it works, put it on the shelf. So that was just prior to the Port Chicago explosion. 1 month later, on 17 August 1944, James Conant again writes to General Groves at the Manhattan Project, and he says, "The decision has been made at Los Alamos. We agree that the Mark II should be put on the shelf. It can be developed for combat use in 3 or 4 months' time, and there is some possibility that the yield can be somewhat improved."
And this was 1 month after the Port Chicago explosion that memo was written.
Yes, and that same memorandum refers, not explicitly but implicitly, to the Port Chicago explosion as the rationale that the Mark II was put on the shelf. And the evidence there that they're discussing Port Chicago is that James Conant in that memorandum says that the explosion that was the radius of Class B damage that occurred was 1/2 mile, and the area of Class B damage was 0.75 square mile. And we know from Los Alamos, now declassified documents, that the radius of Class B damage at the Port Chicago explosion was 0.5 mile. So Port Chicago is specifically cited by this reference to the radius of Class B damage as being the rationale for putting the Mark II on the shelf, knowing that it can be developed for combat use in 3 or 4 months' time, and that there's some possibility of yield increase.
Dean McLeod, tell us who Captain Parsons was, and then you have unearthed some you've done a remarkable piece of work unearthing some memoranda which supplement and I think validate what Peter's done to a tremendous extent. Tell us about William Parsons and then share some of your research with us.
Well, before I do that, I would add one thing about the explosion. In my book, I have a document which came from the Navy that shows the blast zone, and it shows a map of the Bay Area, and the greatest extent of the damage, primarily broken glass, was 40 miles away. It went all the way from Petaluma in the north to Redwood City in the south and east also. So it was an extraordinarily powerful explosion. Also, one of the ships was completely disintegrated. There were no parts remaining, although it was completely obliterated. It's interesting that people have heard that W.S. Parsons was there immediately after the explosion. One of the things that I came across at the National Archives was the war diary from Port Chicago from the installation. And in July, they mentioned this: among the officers and technicians not assigned to duty in the 12th Naval District who visited Port Chicago immediately after the disaster were about 10 individuals, all from Washington, D.C. Captain J.C. Burns, Jr., Captain Radford Moses, Commander M.G. Johnson, Commander J.H. Sides, Lieutenant Commander Dexter Bullard, Captain W.S. Parsons from the Chief of Naval Operations, Colonel Crosby Field, Lieutenant Colonel Earl Stratton, Professor John F. Burchard, who was the chairman of the Dolock Committee from the Office of Scientific Research and Development, Max Beard, and E. Moss Brown. Now, these are all individuals that I give some mention to in the book. I think it's really the first time that they've been connected with Port Chicago in any published material. Of course, Parsons was prominent as the explosives expert in the Manhattan Project. I believe there were 4 primary divisions in the project, and he was responsible for the practical application of doing the engineering for making the 2 atomic bombs.
Captain Parsons was also the bombing officer on board the Enola Gay that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Share some of your memoranda with us, Dean, because I was stunned to see what you've come across. Not that I didn't think it would be there, but I was amazed that somebody was able to come up with it, and it supplements and I think validates the earlier work that Peter did in a tremendous fashion.
Yes, there's a number of several. I've got an entire chronology of that wartime period and references to the memorandum that I've been able to uncover so far. On August 16th, a little less than a month after, W.H. Schindler, who was the officer in charge of the Naval Ordnance Lab in Washington, D.C., wrote a letter to the commanding officers of Port Chicago and Mare Island and provided in the memorandum kudos in the cooperation given to these 2 gentlemen, Brown and Beard, who had come from Washington, D.C., from the Pentagon, and whose, quote, duties were performed in connection with a highly classified and urgent project, and that their efforts shortened the time required to obtain the desired data and information, and the entire project was materially advanced.
Wow.
So basically what we have is a memorandum congratulating these individuals for successfully executing a highly classified project.
Well, they participated in this had specific reference, I believe, to the investigation that followed, and it was really an information gathering group of a number of Washington, D.C. individuals who came to measure and learn everything they could about the explosion. Now, that was in the context of an explosion, but it also, I think, I can't imagine that the explosion would have been considered a highly classified and urgent project. Then there's another one, I think, it's sort of an intriguing quote. This is on the 28th of August, a couple of weeks later. And this is Burchard, who was the scientist working for Dulock. He receives a letter from Warner, who is one of the other individuals in the Manhattan Project, on what he describes a very low day. Dulock, this is quote, Dulock per se worked at the technical level, reported on a tactical level, accomplished no panaceas, contributed intangible guidance and moral support under rather hysterical conditions, and for the using services on the target date, it helped to evaluate the results with as much candor as the negatives demanded.
Dulock, by the way, an acronym for Demolition of Obstacles to Landing Operations Committee.
Yes, and if you, in my timeline, I give some background on what that Dulock was, and it was part of the overall plan that was designed to be able to destroy installations.
We are almost out of time. Dean, translating the documents that you just related for us from bureaucratese to real English, so to speak, as concisely as one can, and then if I could prevail on both of you to give the titles of your respective books and websites, because we're almost out of time.
Well, I'm not sure how to put it in English without editing what the documents say, and I prefer to let the documents speak for themselves.
Will they be available on your website?
They're available on my website, and they're also available in the book that will be coming out.
Fantastic.
Along with the pictures of some of the individuals who are involved.
So that basically people who have had their interest piqued, hopefully they can pursue this and flesh this out for themselves.
Well, and I think there's much more research that can be done, and plenty of room for anyone else who wants to do original research in real documents.
Your book and your website, Dean.
The book is Images of America, Port Chicago. The webpage is web.mac.com/Dean_McLeod, M-C-L-E-O-D, .mac.
All righty. And the title of the book again?
Images of America, Port Chicago.
All righty. And there will be links on the description for this program on the Spitfire website. Peter, same thing, website and book.
The name of the book is The Last Wave from Port Chicago, and it is on the web at www.portchicago.org.
We have been visiting with Peter Vogel, the author of The Last Wave from Port Chicago, and Dean McLeod, the author of Images of America, Port Chicago, and an individual who, I think I speak for Peter, Dean, in saying thanks for entering into this fray, because for so long Peter's been like the lone champion of truth on this, and now, due to your efforts, there's a whole supplemental body of information which I think buttresses his argument in very effective fashion.
And I'm very grateful to the work you've done.
All righty.
Well, thank you. I think that the most important thing to remember is that there is an unlimited amount of research that still could be done on this.
All righty. We have been visiting with Dean McLeod, the author of Images of America, Port Chicago, and Peter Vogel, the author of The Last Wave from Port Chicago. This concludes For the Record, Side 2 of For the Record 605. For Dean McLeod and Peter Vogel, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.